Man, this aircon is racist.
I've never ever been a spy.
Can the VBS bank loot?
The problem is that Pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a shape.
Sergeant at arms, can you please come
on the
in?
Point of order.
Hello and welcome to your weekly dose of political shenanigans with us here at the Sunday Times Politics Desk. This is Sunday Times Politics Weekly with me, Amil Amrao. I'm joined in the studio this week by my colleagues, Juanita Hunter and Apiwe de Klerk. Guys, thank you so much for joining me in studio and thank you all for listening in. We have a jam-packed show for you this week with a special guest phoning in to answer some of our questions. So let's get straight into it. On the line, we have a very brave man who's agreed to be bombarded by our questions and provide clarity on the ongoings within the DA. It's the party spokesperson, Solly Malatsi. He's going to be answering questions around the party's federal council election this weekend in Johannesburg. Now, at the meeting, Musi Maimane's leadership of the party is set to be a point of discussion when a review of the DA's structures and processes is tabled. Now, also, the party will have to elect a new federal council chairperson, a position that's currently held by Jay himself. And he's been holding that position for almost two decades. Now, the position is being contested strongly by DA heavyweights like Helen Ziller, Ethel Trollope, Mike Waters, and Thomas Walters. Mr. Malatsi, thank you so much for joining us. Are you well, sir?
I'm very well. Greetings to all of you.
Yeah, greetings, greetings.
Thank you so much. Now, Mr. Malatsi, the DA is in the midst of a bit of a factional battle here. Are you guys worried at all about the fallout that this meeting could have on this weekend?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think if you were to honestly reflect on the events that have been taking place in the organization over the last 5 weeks or since the election, it is a sense of worry, because while it is understandable that people might have specific interest in terms of the direction of the party along factional lines, at the end of the day, when those differences are not resolved within the internal structures of the organization, they risk the likelihood of impacting on very long-lasting damage to the organization.
Look, do you think a leadership contest outside of, say, an early Congress would be the best solution for the party? Because, I mean, you just came back from a elective Congress as a party. Yes, the elections were a factor, but seemingly the challenge is on the leadership, or rather the leader of the party. Do you think an early Congress would be the main solution for you instead of these proxy battles that are currently playing themselves out now?
Ideally, you wouldn't want to start establishing a culture where you start having early congresses every time there is a big debate ensuing in the organization. But that decision is ultimately the decision that the party membership needs to take. It is not, you know, my opinion of whether it would be right or wrong, useful or not, is meaningless in the space where the decision ultimately lies with the membership of the organization. But the key fundamental thing is instances like an early Congress have far-reaching implications for the organization. Congresses cost a lot of money. Congresses require a lot of time to put the logistics in place in terms of verifying the credentials of those delegates that will need to attend it. So there's a lot of work that goes into putting together a Congress. It also has an impact on the incumbent of provincial leadership across the party. So while there may be a solution in the midst of a very unusual phase in the organization, congresses have far more reaching implications. But the best way to always take the key decision about taking the party forward on a particular route is to take that decision to the general membership of the party, who would be best represented during a Congress rather than a federal council.
I mean, I just wanted to ask you, the ANC often talks about something called sins of incumbency. where the, you know, the bigger it got, the bigger the problems. And I'm wondering if the DA is having its own sense of incumbency moment, and whether the growth of the DA is probably the downfall of the DA.
I mean, there is a fair argument to be made there. The reality of the situation is that growth comes with its own burden. We have noticed that, you know, we have been stressed in terms of taking new role in the coalition government, and both existing coalition governments have come with, you know, difficult political situations for the organization. So at any given time, growth comes with its own burden, and in all honesty, I think we are also experiencing that.
What is the consequence for the South African voter? I mean, you really have to appreciate that this now has a consequence for the South African voter, because the same problems that the ANC is seeing, the DA is seeing.
Look, I mean, it's a very difficult question to respond, especially because I'm conflicted by, you know, the issue of being part of the party's leadership. But I think ultimately voters prefer stability in organizations, and they prefer to have a very stable, politically stable alternative. And in all fairness, the DA has built its brand over the years on our ability to manage internal differences very well, on our ability to overcome difficult phases in the organization without leaders tearing each other apart in the media spectacles that have been taking place in the last few weeks. So when such instances occur, voters remain in doubt about whether there are really credible alternatives. And I think it is something that the leadership of the party is realizing, and it is a firm reminder to all of us that are involved at different levels of leading this organization that, you know, first and foremost, we should be mindful of what we say to the voter. And in all honesty, I also don't think that all hope is lost. You know, we have an opportunity to regroup, because if we get into a phase of perpetual conflict, we will ultimately lose everything that we have spent the last 10 years building this organization to be. So I think on that front, there is an acknowledgement by all different leaders of the organization that we need to get to a place where ultimately these differences that are existing now as a result primarily of our election performance, that we must lead this organization. And there is that recognition, and we are hoping that the federal council over this weekend, in response to the review, will chart that path forward for the party so that we can rededicate all our energies and resources towards interacting with the voters and restoring some of the confidence that some of the voters have lost in the organization, as evidenced in the election performance and the subsequent by-elections in some areas.
Look, when all of these things were playing themselves out in the media, especially the stories that had been written about the leader and so on, there came in a voice that was sort of saying, look, this thing is about race. There have been a number of your leaders who have made reference to race when they were making their arguments, I mean, in opinion pieces publicly. So do you guys have a race problem, or is it an ideological problem? I want you to break it down for our listener. Is this thing of a race problem being exaggerated, or are you really seriously dealing with a racial issue? I mean, the two leaders who have spoken are quite senior in their columns, who have made reference to race. That is both the mayor of the city of Johannesburg and the leader of the party here in Gauteng.
The race is that a lot of the time, when particularly external people look at any current debate that is going on in the organization, they look at a simplistic view that this is Hamad Mashaba speaking about the redress debate in the organization. What gets focused on a lot is you know, his race other than the conscience. The debate that is currently going on in the organization is how do we reframe our research policy in such a way that it recognizes the fact that there was a systematic exclusion of opportunities for people on the basis of race while developing an empowerment policy that does not seek to reproduce some form of racial discrimination. And all the other issues that ensue in terms of who are the people that are contesting leadership at different levels of the organization, be it in the metro in Cape Town or the housing provincial leadership contest, whenever they occur, gets bled within that space. So it's more about the consultation about taking the organization in the direction that many South Africans across race, across culture, across tradition can be comfortable identifying with, rather than being an organization that certain minorities is much more comfortable associating with at the exclusion of others.
Wait, 4 years ago there was a discussion about black leaders being appointed as proxies. When you see the drama and the fights and the issue, you know, the stepping in of the Institute for Race Relations, etc., and some of the public pronouncements, I mean, were you wrong in denying at the time that perhaps some leaders were promoted, even subtly or, you know, as proxies for other white people of the party?
Well, you can argue for both sides, and I can understand why, you know, a lot of people would argue in that day. When you look extensively in terms of the acceleration of different leaders in the organization, either to senior leadership or to very key political, professional political appointments, was to try and maximize the depth at the organization, because what was happening was that the organization was growing at a rapid pace, but the depth of leadership in the organization wasn't responding positively to that growth. So therefore, it demanded that there be a, in exceptional instances where there is what you refer to promotion of other individuals to occupy certain strategic positions in the organization. But I think at any given time, you know, the decisions that an organization takes 4 years ago based on leadership challenges that it has at the time, based on the political landscape, it's different to what would happen right now.
But I mean, you can admit,
if you compare the depth of leadership that the party has now to 5 years ago, it has made advances in certain areas. But of course, I mean, in any key of life, in politics, in business, every decision has its pros and cons. And when you get to a phase where in a lifespan of a political organization, there isn't growth anymore, and there is heated political discussion about certain leaders allegedly to incumbents, then those arguments naturally will come to the fore. And hindsight is always the best, you know, indicator of how certain decisions could have been handled. But I don't think the anticipation was such that through the promotion of certain individuals to occupy strategic positions in the organization, because that is what the party needed at the time, their intention was to make people proxies of other individuals.
Mr. Malatsi, good luck for this weekend. Thanks again.
Next time you must join us in studio.
Of course.
We want to grill him properly. This thing on the phone is not giving us a proper chance.
We're going to take a very short break, and when we get back into it, we're going to be talking about Juanita's weekend story about some big developments or some big battles within the state security agency. Join us then.
Racial identity politics, a phrase that has the potential to start an argument in just about any situation. That's why we're starting it first. Let's Start an Argument is a unique and insightful podcast series about the meaning of race to us today. Presented by researcher Cecilia Koch and Doctor of Philosophy Jason Werbeloff, the series aims to spark rational argument and meaningful discussion around this controversial topic. Fine, let's start an argument now on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, Kwanita, you wrote an interesting story in the Sunday Times this past weekend. It says that the state security minister, Ayanda Dlodlo, has fallen out with two of her top spies. Now, one of them is Sam Wofe, who is in charge of the domestic spying branch. Now, the cause of the fallout, as you reported, is said to have been over the intelligence agency's failure to anticipate xenophobic violence that erupted in Gauteng last month. And we all know how that turned out. Mm. Tell us more about that story.
So I like to like start right at the bottom, right? So just indulge me a little bit, right? But so we do know that the intelligence agency in South Africa has been a mess. Mm. When Ramaphosa came in, he identified this. He then decided to set up a panel, a high panel, led by former Minister Sidney Mufamadi, yeah, where they did a review and they came up with a report. And somewhat that report, the redacted version at least, was scathing, in terms of how money was looted, how the organization was used for political agenda, and that's the agenda of Jacob Zuma, and how a sort of separate intelligence agency was set up to serve Zuma in the form of the Special Operations Unit, the SO. So a lot was said, and last year Ramaphosa appointed Dipuo Letsatsi Duba, who was one of his main supporters in the CR17 campaign, and then she was then removed at this after the elections, and Ayanda Dlodlo was appointed. But one of the main recommendations that was made by the panel was that the intelligence agency revert back to the structure it initially was, where you have the Secret Service that deals with foreign intelligence, and you have NIA, which is the National Intelligence Agency that deals with domestic. So what happened was it was merged under Zuma, where intelligence and foreign was just state security agency with one director general, right? So what happened was so Ayanda Dlodlo comes in, and there is this kind of uncertainty. There's a whole lot of issues in terms of, you know, money being stolen and endless problems, right? But and also just the inability of the intelligence agency to do its job is also something that has been persisting. And she comes in, and some months later in August, Ramaphosa announces that he has appointed Advocate Sam Wofe as the head of the domestic branch.
Him and Ramaphosa are close, aren't they?
Right. Now, you will remember his background from the State Capture Commission, where he came and testified, etc. But he's Ramaphosa's childhood friend. They grew up together in Soweto. He was an integral part of the CR17 campaign. And I'm quite surprised that even myself, we didn't write at the time that Ramaphosa effectively appointed his buddy to head the intelligence agency. And his only experience was like a three-month gig as legal advisor to the former Minister of Intelligence. He has no intelligence expertise before that. He used to work, you know, as advisor to a minister before that at the SIU, after that at the SIU, in the governance unit. So that's where it starts, right? The second thing is that there is this atmosphere in the NP in the state security agency that's I investigate you, you investigate me, I suspect you, you suspect me.
Of course.
Which is, and we get involved in political dynamics. I'm for the minister, I'm for the president, I have a, you know, that kind of thing. But the reality of it is exactly what Zuma did in 2009, where he fetched Dlomo, what is his name? Glomo's name? It'll come to me now. But the guy who was then sent as an ambassador to Japan, he was an ordinary person in security in the office of the MEC in KZN, and then he was promoted to the state security agency. That's exactly what Ramaphosa did, and we don't call him out for that. Now there's this fallout, and the fallout is in my right of things. So it stems from the president, if you read our story, the president expressing his concern when the violence started to the minister and saying, you're not what is the state of the intelligence agency? And when she then conveys this message, and then she writes a letter to Moafe, where she says, give me reasons why I shouldn't suspend you, because the guy, the taxi driver, was killed in Pretoria. There was retaliation. There was violence against foreign nationals, and there's zero intelligence. And when intelligence does come, it's shoddy and it comes late. And then that just spiraled, because at a subsequent strategic planning meeting, the minister is said to have made an illegal instruction to intercept the phone of a kingpin of this violence, a man who was said to have been organizing raids in the Fordsburg area. And so
this is without a court order.
Was it illegal? Wait, so I'll tell you why it's... So she said, we need to intercept this guy's communication. And they said, we can't get a judge. And she said, well, if you can't get a judge, just do it anyway.
Yeah.
Right? So some people were saying this is an illegal order. Her defenders have said that she believed that the Constitution trumps that law in the sense that right to life is more important than this person. But I mean, there's a whole argument that can happen as a result of that. They obviously complained to the president, and effectively there's a push now to have the minister fired, right? So there's this on one hand, the minister, you know, saying, I'm not been getting proper intelligence from you guys. So this is Sam Moafe and the acting DG, Loyisa Jafta. And on the other hand, they're telling the president, oh, actually, she's giving us illegal instructions. Now, this is factionalism at its core. The reality of it is that President Ramaphosa's hands are not clean in this, because he has enabled Moafe to run state security as if he doesn't need any oversight. And he has a direct line to the president. So it's almost as if he is, protected, right? But the other hand, did the minister give an illegal instruction? That's a huge deal.
Yeah.
So these issues are not going to fix itself. And what's going to happen now is that if you see with the leaks, it's going to be selective leaking of this, selective leaking of that, selective leaking of that, as they fight each other. And the reality of it is that the stability and the security of our state is in the hands of people who are literally fighting for their jobs. Mm.
Kaneta, my first question when I read the one story from
the
other guys there,
the opposition,
and then yours, was that, is this a good fight to be had? Is it a good fight to be had for us as the citizens? Because these guys have been found wanting, whether or not she gave an illegal instruction, that we ought to discuss, but you know, at a level of at a political level, but at a level where you are saying, but in the capital city of South Africa, there's just violence and there's no intelligence to inform. City of Johannesburg is one of the most important cities in Africa, and then there's no intelligence. So is this discussion going to allow us to benefit as the country, because these people are being found out every time? People have been having these discussions about them, but at the time it was just said, Zuma has crippled the institutions. But then now, in a process where we are saying we are reforming, we are rebuilding, still we are having these things. So is this going to be a good discussion that is going to benefit us, do you think?
So I think it's important that we're writing about it. I don't know if that answers your question, because it's creating an awareness that even with this new dawn phenomenon, the same, that they are actually fighting each other now. These are not Zuma people. This is a Ramaphosa-appointed minister and Ramaphosa-appointed head of domestic branch that are now fighting each other.
So the politics of CR and Zuma are not tainting about...
This is personality, this is power, this is money, right? And the reality of it is that the State Security Agency has acted with so much of impunity. They have a black budget. We don't know how much money they have. They deal with cash, meaning there's no oversight, right? So on one hand, you can have the minister saying this, or the minister's supporter saying that this is an effort to derail her from putting mechanisms in place because of the years and years of impunity. On the other hand, it's, this minister wants to interfere in our operations of the agency. But what operations when you are not giving intelligence. Mm. So there's that kind of double-edged sword, right?
Mm.
But for me, what's important, and it was rather towards the end of the story, my story, not that one you read.
We read all stories.
was the state of the organization can be seen through the number of vacancies, right? I'll give you some examples. You'll cry with me. There are 8 DDGs. So 8 people who earn, how much do DDGs earn? In the 1 point somethings,
yeah,
right?
Probably,
and probably even more because it's intelligence, right? However, there are only 7 positions. So there's 8 DDGs and there are 7 positions. But of the 8 DDGs, only 2 are in positions. The rest, so the 6, come to work and don't get and do nothing.
What? Well, I'm not really surprised, to be honest.
Right?
These are DDGs.
Right? These are not officials, right? Yeah. It gets worse. So meaning there are 6 people that come to work, get paid and do nothing. And the rest of the positions, the of the 7 positions, 5 positions, there's acting people there. And obviously those acting people get allowances because they're acting.
It's Hollywood out there.
No, it's Hollywood, right? Now if you look at general managers, right? There are 37 general managers for 34 positions, but there are 24 vacancies.
What?
Meaning 11 people are unplaced and 12 people are displaced. Meaning that 22 people come to work and for nothing. On managers, there are 44 vacancies and 48 of the 91 positions, 48 people are acting.
Wow.
So it's terrific. A mess. And yeah. The reality of it is that now it's hard for the public. Who do you believe? Do you believe the minister? Do you believe the people of intelligence? My thing is so simple. As Ramaphosa now has to intervene because they've written to him, the minister had to repeat, is what, number one, sort out your vacancy issues.
Yeah.
Send people back to their post and get people permanent. Mm. That's number one.
And the right people permanent.
Number two, we as the public must not forget that it is Ramaphosa's buddy. He appointed his buddy to a senior position just like Jacob Zuma did.
Mm.
And just like how Jacob Zuma did it, this organization can be further plundered because there's a man, maybe Ramaphosa is not acting with impunity, but the person that he has appointed and given all this power to can act with impunity.
And in situations like that, so long as the people that report to him or the people that work with him know that this guy
has a direct line with number one
president, they will follow even when he's doing the wrong. Yeah. That's what we've learned from the Zuma era.
Exactly.
And then the last thing is overhauling intelligence has to happen subsequent to fixing the organization. The stories that you will hear about the archaic ways of following journalists and tapping journalists' calls and tapping politicians and finding out what Ace Magashule is doing and not worrying about real threats to society and not getting up to the times where they're so obsessed with, I need a grabber, we need to, you know, that kind of, and that's the consequence of an intelligence agency was at the disposal of Jacob Zuma. Now's the time to modernize it, to take it up to a level where it's actively contributing to your crime problem in South Africa, that it's actively contributing to your service delivery violence protest problem in South Africa, where it is preempting failures at state-owned entities. And so that is what a professionalized state security agency is. We may think that these are people fighting from the farm there in Delmas and the head offices in Menlyn. No, this affects every one of us. Because they can be a threat to the security of this nation, and our intelligence agencies are fighting who's a better minister.
Oh, well, I guess Kranita will tell us all about that and all the horror stories.
I wish I come with good news
in her book.
We have another one for next Sunday, eh?
Huh?
This coming Sunday, we have another one from that fight.
No, guys. Guys, I can't be in the fighting squad every week.
But anyway, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you so much for joining me in studio, guys. And thank you so much for everyone who's listening in. Remember, if you want to advertise on this podcast, you can email smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. That's smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. Have a good one. Catch you next week.